You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 17th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Assistant Professor of Education at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Jack Schneider. In his books, Excellence for All, How a New Breed of Reformers is Transforming America's Public Schools. Also on the program today, 170 military personnel already in Baghdad. Another 100 or so to follow, according to President Obama yesterday. And while the heartwarming story of how Raul Labrador will unlikely to become a House Majority Leader, because he didn't have the phone numbers of his fellow congresspeople. The Kochs coming out of the dark to spread, what is it, the Coke adds life? And apparently $250 million to the midterm elections. More on the implications of this administrative version of ENDA by President Obama that impacts only federal contractors to be signed today, it's my understanding. And then yesterday, I know Michael and Matt spoke about the reception a Muslim reporter received at the Texas Republican State Convention for being so offensive as to wear a hijab in a place where a bunch of people wearing cowboy hats for no apparent reason. The Heritage Foundation, in their Secrets to Benghazi panel, end up attacking a Muslim woman who is there, apparently works at Heritage. And the story of a little town in Kentucky that appears to be, to have nationalized, or I guess municipalized, their gas supply. All that and more on today's program. Just a reminder, folks, it is your memberships that make this show possible. Without your memberships, we cannot do this show. Much of that is going now towards throat lozenges for me so that I can maintain my voice. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Jack Schneider.
Through the window, I'm looking through a pane of glass. Look through the window.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a welcome, it's a pleasure, I should say, to welcome to the program assistant professor of at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Mass., author of Excellence for All, How a New Breed of Reformers is Transforming America's Public Schools, and also hosts a blog with Michelle Rhee at Education Week entitled K through 12 Schools Beyond the Rhetoric. Welcome to the program, Jack Schneider.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start. Let's make our way into this with the recent Vergara ruling. Just now, this is a trial court judge, a superior court in California, who ruled that California's contract with teachers violates the state's constitutional guarantee to an equitable education, because, in particular, because of what is known as teachers' tenure. Now, it's not the same as college professors' tenure, but tell us what that system is and just some of the basic details of that case.
Sure. In California, teachers acquire permanent status after, you know, roughly 18 months in the classroom. So we're talking about two school years of teaching here. That's a fairly standard figure nationwide. In some states, it's 3 years. It's been agreed to as a part of the collective bargaining process. And what that means is not that a teacher has a job for life, but rather that a teacher is entitled to all of the due process procedures that are also negotiated as part of the collective bargaining process. And those two were contested in the Vergara case. And so, you know, a figure that has been thrown out repeatedly is that it can take years and years and $500,000 legal fees to dismiss a teacher. And so there are aspects of the case where they are identifying some problems, that it shouldn't take that long to dismiss an ineffective teacher. But again, all of this due process is in place for a reason. Once upon a time, teachers could be dismissed fairly arbitrarily for expressing political opinions in the classroom, for teaching evolution, for getting married in the case of women. And so to say that we're going to throw all of that out in order to get rid of some of these problems that could actually be worked at through the collective bargaining process is an unnecessarily reactionary kind of position. And even though there are some who support the Vergara decision who say that they are not in favor of throwing out due process and they are not in favor of throwing out the collective bargaining process, there certainly is an ideological component to all of this, and there certainly are organizations that absolutely would love to do that, that would like for it to be possible to fire a teacher at will at any time of the day, any day of the year. And I have some real problems with that. And there's, you know, a lot of scholarship that indicates that this would have really dramatic impacts on the teaching profession for a variety of different reasons, including the fact that it'll make teaching a less attractive job. And also it'll influence teachers' ability to do what they think is in the best interest of children in the classroom. And so that cuts both ways. You often hear reformers saying that it should be about what's the best interest of students, not what's in the best interests of adults. But of course, what's in the best interests of teachers is often very much what's in the best interest of students.
All right, I'm going to bypass the sort of picking apart the trial judges. You know, interpretation of the state constitution, we should remind people of California. There's a lot of people who think that the trial judge really stretched some legal principles in terms of proving whether or not the idea that you can't fire teachers somehow as easily as some people think you should be able to necessarily impacts the education opportunities in a disparate fashion between, let's say, affluent and less affluent kids. This is going to go to appeal, but I think it's you know, part of the reason why this case was brought in the first place was as part of that movement to weaken teacher protections. So let's maintain that plane as we go forward. Maybe at another time I'll deal with the sort of the legal issues. Maybe when we get to the appellate level. But you know, there was just a story Monday out of Indiana where a teacher complained that he got fired because he was sort of out about his atheism. And it's just another, I mean, that's sort of the low-hanging fruit in terms of why you don't want to leave teachers so vulnerable to being fired. But you also bring up a very good a reason in the context in your piece in the LA Times about the way that teachers improve over time. Let's talk about that, because so much of this is lost in these ideological battles. And I would say, and I know that, and we will get to this, that I know that you are more generous in your sense of the intent of a lot of these battles. But so much is lost in terms of just the nuance of what actually makes for a good teacher and what makes ultimately for a good education. So talk about that dynamic, about how teachers improve, and if we really wanted to get better teachers, we would do things differently than just firing a small percentage who we think is bad after 2 years.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So recall that we need more than 3 million teachers in our classroom. And so my serious concern here is that let's imagine that you make it easier to fire teachers and you get rid of, let's imagine that this figure that was in fact plucked out of thin air, that 1-3% of teachers are grossly ineffective.
Let's wait a second. I want to highlight that, because that broke yesterday. Will you expand on that? I mean, because this was incredible.
Sure,
broke yesterday. Go ahead.
So David Berliner, who I don't believe knew how his testimony would be used, was asked, based on student standardized test scores, which he is actually a critic of, how many teachers would you say are grossly ineffective? And he said, you know, that plucking a number out of thin air, he would say 1-3%. And so, you know, this number, which is now being used as if it is a real figure representing real research, represents a misleading fact in two senses. One is that the person who generated it freely admits that he plucked it out of thin air. And second, he would be the first one to say that the data upon which he is basing that guess is itself flawed data, because it measures only a very narrow range of what teachers actually do in the classroom. And of course, the spillover effects from one teacher to another make it very hard to address the extent to which a teacher is responsible for student standardized test score gains. You know, Sam, if you taught history and I taught English and the scores of your students were going up in their reading comprehension passages, maybe it's because of my instruction in the English classroom, or vice versa, or maybe it's because of the teacher they had the year before you. And so David Berliner would, I think, be among the very first to say the figure is a pretty useless one. But to get back to your original question, even if we assume that that figure is a real one, so now we've gotten rid of the worst 1-3% of teachers. And the fact is that we still are going to have nearly 3 million teachers in our schools who aren't getting any better as a result of this. You know, there's a lot of research that is based on student standardized test scores where scholars, largely economists, who don't really know how schools work, have attempted to price out, you know, what is the effect? If a student gets 9 ineffective teachers in a row, well, what are the odds that a student is truly getting 9 grossly ineffective teachers in a row? And then my question is, if that student truly is getting 9 ineffective teachers in a row, you've got a much bigger problem than teacher tenure. You've got a school that is going down the toilet because nobody's paid attention to it, because the kids in that school know they've been abandoned, because the school doesn't have adequate resources, and because good teachers don't want to be in that school. And so once more, to come back to your point, what we ought to be doing is encouraging great teachers to get into the profession so that we have a super competitive pool of applicants who are fighting with each other to get into our public schools. And furthermore, we ought to be doing everything we can to ensure that all of the teachers who are currently in our schools are getting better. And this, to me, is a much bigger issue than saying, you know, there are some bad teachers out there someplace. Well, that's true. There are bad members of every occupation and every profession. There are bad doctors out there. And we work to identify them and not go to them. And we can do the same with teaching. But getting rid of a few bad teachers is somehow a magic solution or a silver bullet here. And to pretend that there are such a large number of grossly ineffective teachers that this is going to solve some sort of problem is to miss the real issue, which is that teachers could get better. All teachers could get better. And we have a lot of data on this, that teachers are professionals with a lot of skills and they do improve, but they could improve a lot more. And one of the reasons that they don't improve across the full arc of their careers is that we don't adequately invest in professional development for them. We don't give them time to meet with each other, to collaborate. American teachers teach something like 50% more hours during the school week than their counterparts in other industrialized nations. In fact, I got an email from someone in France this week who wrote to me after reading that entry tax piece.
I'm sorry, could you say that again? Your phone's breaking up just a little bit.
Sure. I got an email from someone in France this week reacting to my piece in the LA Times and responding to the statistic I cited about the number of hours a week that American teachers teach in the classroom. And he said, can this be true? I can't believe American teachers teach that many hours. In France, he says, we teach 18 hours a week in the classroom. He wasn't sure. Maybe the contract has changed to 18.5 hours a week. And that is the equivalent, given what teachers have to do in terms of planning, meeting together, doing professional development, meeting with families, meeting with students. He said 18 hours of instruction translates to 45 hours a week of work, or 40 hours a week of work. And so, you know, the notion that we are going to solve any of our problems by not addressing these fundamental concerns about the structure of the profession, about the lure of the profession. It's almost comical to me. If it wasn't so sad, I would laugh at it. But the fact is that if we really care about American education, what we ought to be doing is first doing everything we can to make teaching an attractive occupation that teachers get better at every single year and feel good about and feel like they're growing in, to pay them enough so that they feel like this is something they can stay in and support a family. The average teacher makes about $57,000 a year on average, which isn't bad, but it means that you're going to lose a lot of teachers, a lot of potential teachers, to other occupations.
Because people should also remember, I mean, it's the teachers make slightly over, I think, what is the median income in this country. But in terms of education, they far surpass the median. So
absolutely.
And all right. Well, so let me just stop you there, because there's a lot to digest in what you've just said. And I think, you know, it begs the question again that if it is the case, I mean, again, and I want to also just highlight that Berliner announced that he had pulled that figure 1 to 3% of bad teachers out of the air was not clear in the course of the trial. Nobody realized that was a sort of made up number that somebody was just sort of taking a guesstimate at. Never mind the fact that the underpinnings for that guesstimate are also suspect. Even if you accept that standardized testing is an accurate measure of how students are doing, you have the problem of attributing it to a teacher, and then you've just made up a figure. But so aside from that particular part about it, this notion that you're promoting, the idea that particularly in teaching, the idea of professional development. I mean, I went to a dentist at one point, my favorite dentist in the world. He since seems to have retired. But this guy would keep going down to conventions on getting his super dentistry, his master's in dentistry. He was the best dentist I ever had. We don't allow for that type of teacher development because that falls into the rubric of you're paying too much attention to the adults. We got to be focusing this on the kids. If we know that at or we suspect that we know there's 1 to 3% of teachers, we also know that we don't have like it's not like these 1 to 3% teachers are taking places of all the people running to become teachers. Particularly in difficult schools, what do you attribute the intense focus by those who would reform education on that aspect? I mean, that's, you know, and I know, that's where I become very suspect of the ideological agenda of those who focus on this tiny element of the education quandary, if you will.
Sure. Yeah. I think the real issue here is that we have an incredibly complex system. Why is it so complex? Well, because it serves every kid in our very large nation, and that's one of the amazing things about it. It's also complex because education is a very complex enterprise. You know, we often are compared to other nations that can produce higher standardized test scores. So they'll often point to, East Asian educational systems, which, you know, will kick us around a little bit in terms of math scores. But we happen to be a country that believes that education is about far more than cramming a few subjects into a kid's head. Now, that's a part of it. That's certainly a big part of it. But we also want kids to come out doing a whole lot of other things, including being creative and being able to solve problems and being decent human beings. All of that makes education incredibly complex. Add to that the fact that we want to do things in a fair and equitable manner. We want to treat adults fairly. We want to treat children fairly. And so all of this makes the system a little bit cumbersome to negotiate, right? Especially given the size. Reformers don't like that. Reformers fancy themselves to be CEOs. What they want to be able to do is they want to cut through the red tape. That's a phrase you hear very frequently. Well, a lot of that red tape exists for a reason, so that it will protect people, so that it will give people an equal shake at things. Yes, it can be quite challenging. When I deal with the bureaucracies of school government, I can get frustrated too. When I am trying to go through a school board to acquire data, or when I'm trying to find time to meet with somebody and I have to sign 16 permission slips, you know, this can be difficult. But the thing about bureaucracies is that they are fair. Nobody gets to cut the line in a bureaucracy. And one of the things that reformers hate about that is that they feel supremely confident that they have solutions. Well, if you feel supremely confident that you have solutions and you are used to throwing your weight around, it is going to be pretty frustrating to navigate your way through a system that is both democratic and bureaucratic. And I don't use bureaucratic in a negative sense. Again, a part of what a bureaucracy does, it's from the word bureau, meaning to file things away. We keep records of things in our public schools, right? We don't say that somebody gets to have something just because they came with a smile on their face on a particular day. If one person gets it, everybody gets it. Well, reformers don't like that. And so this, combined with the fact that they are supremely confident in their own ideas, leads to them bad-mouthing the way things are done. So status quo has become a very negative phrase. Well, it just so happens to be that the status quo in American education is better than it's ever been in the entire history of our country. Our schools get better every year. Reformers are also ignorant of history. You know, they like to imagine that 50 years ago, the schools were much better. Well, I have news for you. 50 years ago, a lot of kids still didn't have access to schools, much less integrated schools. Now, we still struggle with that, but we're getting better. Reformers don't like to move slowly. They want to move quickly. Again, they see themselves as CEOs in this enterprise. Apple Computer doesn't move slowly. Why should our schools? Well, Apple Computer doesn't employ 3.1 or 3.2 million teachers. Apple Computer doesn't serve every kid in America and say that every kid in America can show up at its doors for free, usually get a breakfast and a lunch out of it if they can't afford it, have some adults take care of them all day and care about them. Those adults who happen to also be highly skilled and highly trained, education is not a business. And so, you know, the critique about a kind of corporate approach to reform, I don't tend to see it as being driven by profit. I tend to see it as being driven by a kind of corporate ethos, a kind of private sector thinking about the world. And it doesn't really apply to schools.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we spoke on Ring of Fire Radio the other day, and the idea of, you know, everybody's an expert on schools because we all went to one is, you know, there's not a lot of those things. I experienced that back when I was involved in TV more, because everybody watches TV, so they all know what it takes. And I want to talk about, you know, there's been stories about how Common Core was ushered in basically at the, I mean, I don't want to say the whim, although it certainly seems like the whim of Bill Gates. That's not necessarily a reflection on the merits of it or not, but that's the reality of it. But before we get there, I want to talk about just sort of the quality of our schools, because you have also written, I think it was back in March, that one of the biggest problems with public schools at this point is simply the branding. And you know, this is one thing that in New York I have noticed as a public school kid parent, that when Success Academy comes into the neighborhood, it is like the opening of literally a retail outlet, like a major retail outlet. You get the glossy pamphlets, you get this barrage of marketing materials, and it's stunning. Talk about that aspect of it.
Sure, yeah. You know, this is one of the things that gets me the most, actually, about reformers, is they care so much about the public schools, and they care so much about the public schools that they are willing to engage in insane rhetoric about crisis in order to generate momentum for reform proposals. Well, in that insane rhetoric, you have all sorts of messages about failure and crisis and how our schools are neither safe nor academically adequate. And my goodness, you know, what does a parent know? We know we send our kids to school. The schools look okay from the outside. The teachers we interact with seem to be okay. But many parents are professional researchers. You know, many parents assume that what they hear from the so-called experts must be true, that the schools must be in crisis. Well, if I hear that, all of a sudden I'm going to start questioning whether or not it's a good idea to send my kid to a public school. Private schools certainly don't send that message. Charter schools certainly don't send that message. They're very intentional about their marketing, and they know that parents don't have access to great information. So what do? Take them on a tour to the computer lab where you see all the new equipment. Do computers mean that students are learning, that students are cared for, that students are safe? Absolutely not. You know, it'd be nice to have new computers in every classroom, but there's not any research that indicates that students are going to learn any more, feel any safer, have stronger relationships with the adults in the building. And so when we engage in rhetoric about school crisis, what we're doing is we're undermining public faith in the public schools. And this is, in my mind, the key problem that our public schools face, is that parents believe that good schools are a limited supply and that they've got to compete with each other for these good schools. And so as a result, they move out to the suburbs because they don't think city schools can hack it. They send their kids to private schools. You know, they elbow each other out to try to get to whatever the new charter brand school is. And as a result, we end up with schools where kids who have low-income parents who don't have access to information, parents who don't have political capital, parents who can't buy a new house someplace, parents who lack information about whatever the ostensibly best school in the neighborhood is, who are sending their kids all to the same school, and that school then ends up with a disproportional number of kids who are truly high needs kids and who may not have parents who are giving them all of the advantages at home. Those schools then produce lower test scores.
That's right.
Naturally, which reinforces the message that it's a bad school, and you've got a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy there. And I have a big problem with doing any sort of damage to the brand of an institution or an organization that is designed to serve the public purpose. You know, I talked about Apple Computer before. There are people who don't like Apple. I don't care if they don't like Apple. Apple doesn't serve my kid. My daughter, you know, she likes to screw around on a computer, but it's not going to make a difference in her life. The school she goes to is going to make a difference in her life, as are the schools attended by all of the kids who attend America's public schools. And so when we say negative things about those schools, especially when those negative things are uninformed or underinformed, then what happens is we damage those schools. We drive engaged parents away. We drive well-resourced parents away. We foster segregation. We foster separation. We weaken the schools that are most vulnerable. We weaken schools that weren't vulnerable in the first place. And so I really have a problem within the rhetoric of crisis, and I'd really like to see reformers back down on that and start acknowledging that our schools are, by and large, pretty darn good. And if you look at surveys of parents, Phi Delta Kappa and Gallup do a survey every single year where they ask parents and the public about the quality of the public schools. Well, lo and behold, attitudes about the nation's public schools continue to get worse and worse, with Americans seeing our nation's schools as earning a C average or a D average on an A through F scale. But you ask them, how about the school attended by your own kids? And they say, oh, that's an A or a B. All of them agree. Well, it can't be both ways, right? We can't all think our own kids attend schools that are okay and then think that every school other than the schools attended by our own kids are somehow in crisis. Either the schools are in crisis or they aren't. And our own experiences tell us, my kid's coming home, learning stuff, feeling safe, feeling cared for, becoming a better person, being responsible. Well, if all of us feel this way, and it's something 90% of parents who give their schools an A or a B, if all of us feel this way, then it must be true, right? If our schools were truly in crisis, we would have a society that was truly in crisis. We're the richest country in the world. We're the freest country in the world. Well, a big part of that is because of our schools. And so just to say it one more time, the rhetoric of crisis needs to stop, and people need to start pushing back against it.
And we should also point out that by any measures that we have available to us, there is no significant disparity between private schools and public schools or charter schools and public schools. And to the extent that there is, often public schools come out ahead in these instances.
Yeah. If you do an apples to apples comparison, public schools come out looking pretty good.
And so, you know, I mean, and this is not to say, I mean, just give me your sense of what's happening with charters, because to my mind, charters were developed as a means in which to basically be laboratories where you could develop specific new ideas and then inject them into ideas that are scalable, that you can inject into the public school system. I think in New York, something like 94% of kids in the public school who get public school education funds are in just classic public schools. 6% are in charters. They get an inordinate amount of cash in addition to all the cash that they raise outside of it. They don't have the same requirements in terms of dealing with a broad cross section of kids. Yet we have a governor in this state who basically said that government's job is to protect the charter school movement. It seems like that the idea of charters have mutated from being a means to an end.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Albert Shanker, the former head of the American Federation of Teachers, was a big proponent of charter schools. In the late 80s, and you're exactly right on your history, he pitched charter schools as laboratory schools, as places where the unions would back off on some of their requirements, and the district would back off on some requirements, giving teachers a little bit more room to create and to experiment. And the idea got hijacked, and the idea got turned into one about silver bullets. And this is what I talk about in my first book, Excellence for All, where, you know, it's just well documented in the things these reformers say and in the reforms they pursue. They believe that there are these silver bullets out there, and if we could just find them, we could solve all of America's problems. Well, there are no silver bullets. I talked earlier on the show today about how complex our system is. In any complex system, H.L. Mencken tells us, there is a solution that is easy, simple, and wrong. We need complex solutions for complex problems. And the idea that just by getting rid of a union contract, for instance, you are going to turn schools around. And a lot of charter supporters like charters because most charters aren't unionized. Well, I've got news for you. Some charters are unionized, and they tend to do just as well as the charters that aren't unionized. And again, if you do an apples-to-apples comparison of kids in charter schools versus kids who are in traditional public schools, the kids in traditional public schools look pretty good. Why? Because who sends their kids to a charter school? Well, it's the parents who know that this school is getting results, and they're going to get on the list, and they're going to claw and scratch their way into that school. Well, any parent who cares that much is going to produce a kid who does well in school, no matter where that kid goes to school. And furthermore, when we talk about charters on the whole get results that are about the same as traditional public schools for a lot of the reasons that you would expect. Now, some outperform, and some charter schools are really incredible places, and those charter schools are completely congruent with the original mission of charter schools, which was to be laboratories. And other charter schools are such wretched disasters, because what happens when you take away all of the bureaucratic provisions that ensure that an environment is safe and that the adults are trained? You take away some of these regulations, and the flyers will fly, and those who are going to sink are really going to sink to the bottom. And so if we think about this as a laboratory, then we realize, okay, well, now we've got to learn some things. If we're going to do this everywhere, then, you know, maybe we need to think twice about saying that, you know, teachers aren't required to be licensed in the area they teach, or whatever the experiment might be. But if we think about it as a kind of silver bullet solution, then just immediately on the face of the evidence, we have to reject it, because there are tons of charter schools that are just abysmal failures.
Right.
And so if charters alone were a solution, there would be no failures. Well, there are lots of failures. And so what this should tell us is that charters alone are not a solution. They're a means to an end, as you said. The means is experimentation, and the end has to be bringing those lessons about whatever works. If something does work, or if a practice is promising, to begin to think about how we can integrate that into the system that serves the vast majority of students in our country.
I just want to begin to wrap up, but looking at this from a sort of a political angle on some level. I mean, you are obviously someone who is heavily invested in changing the conversation, right? I mean, that's presumably, I assume that's why you're doing this blog with Michelle Rhee, getting this message out about stopping the crisis talk and you're motivated. One of the things that I have found in speaking to educators who all have this perspective of that educating, there is no silver bullet, that the idea of sort of top-down, one-size-fits-all solutions is an anathema to the idea of education, that the education really happens between the teacher and the student, and each student is different, and each teacher is different, and there's a tremendous amount of nuance and complexity in teaching kids. That is a very hard message to encapsulate in a world where you have millionaires and billionaires out there who are pushing for various reasons the idea that what we need to do is get rid of teacher unions and free up the system. What we need to do is put free market values into our schools. What we need to do is, you know, invest in students, not in teachers. Their very approach lends to a marketing slogan, whereas the educator's approach, by its very nature, does not. How do you overcome the vast amount of money and marketing skill that is pushing this ideological corporatization, if you want to call it, of our education?
It's a great question, and you're absolutely right that, you know, as I said earlier, that we have a really complex system and a simple answer is inherently going to be wrong. But, of course, a simple answer is going to be an easier to digest answer, and it's going to be one that is easily travels across the political stratosphere. In terms of what you do about that and how you counter it is that I think two things are important. One is I think it's important for parents whose kids are in public schools to begin speaking out on Twitter, on Facebook, in face-to-face interactions, talking about the experience that their kids are having in school. Because we know for a fact, research tells us, that a lot of the messages that come across in education come across by travel of word of mouth and in face-to-face interactions. And so parents can play a key role there in sending a positive message about the schools their kids attend. And we, again, know from research that parents are very satisfied with the schools their kids attend. And then the other thing that I would say is that scholars need to stand up, because scholars know this stuff as well. There are thousands of scholars of education, and a tiny fraction are speaking up and speaking out. You know, I got a Twitter account about a year ago because I wanted to start reaching the public. You know, when I publish a journal article, I probably reach 50 people, believe it or not. A couple hundred if I'm really lucky, in terms of the number who actually read it. When I write an op-ed, I get a few more, you know, a couple thousand maybe actually read the piece in the newspaper. But I'm interacting every single day in social media with teachers, with policymakers. I'm followed on Twitter by a state head of education, as well as a couple hundred teachers. And I wish every scholar would do this, because if you just look at the evidence, you're going to be led in the direction of complexity and away from silver bullet solutions. Parents are interested in knowing more about schools. They just don't know where to start. And so I view it as a social responsibility of scholars. It's a part of our civic duty. That citizenship isn't just voting or serving on a jury. It's bringing your talents to bear on the entire polis. Well, you know, I happen to have a small talent in being able to read and assess educational research. So that's my job. Other people with different skills, that's their job, to bring that to the public so that we can all gain from it as a result. So I see it as being a dual project of parents speaking out about their personal experiences and scholars speaking out about what the evidence tells us.
Jack Schneider on Twitter at edu_historian, a professor at Holy Cross. I got to put in a plug for Worcester. I don't know if you were aware, but on the day you were on, you on Ring of Fire, I had another former Worcester native, and I of course, grew up in Worcester as well. So it's always... spent my fair share of time on the Holy Cross campus, not learning anything that didn't involve alcohol, I have to say. But that was a long time ago. Jack Schneider, thanks so much for your time today. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and then head into the funner half of the program, where we will have all the fun in the world like we had at the Heritage Foundation the other day. This is just an unbelievable story. It wraps it all up in one, doesn't it? Sort of, on some level, the the delusion of this poor woman who was attacked by her friends at the Heritage Foundation for being Muslim, who attending a Benghazi hearing. We've just gone completely insane. I mean, we've just gone completely insane, particularly in the days when we have to see all these neocons on television again. I just don't know how I'm going to handle it. I really don't. I really don't.
On top of everything else, they just got a Benghazi suspect, and Joe Walsh, the former congressman, and now he's a talk show guy, right?
Oh, really? Is he a talk show guy?
I believe he's a right-wing talk show guy.
Okay.
He tweeted, "Glad we nabbed a Benghazi suspect, but the timing is questionable. Did they let him wander, waiting for the perfect political opportunity?" And that's the type of insight that you can expect to hear endlessly for the rest of our lives until we all die.
Look at Michael over here. Obama has him by a string. Bringing up this Benghazi suspect that's been captured just to distract us from Benghazi.
We're going.
The capturing of the Benghazi suspect is a way of just...
It's a distraction from Benghazi.
Of course. Matt has cracked the code.
He cracked the code. That was it. But the only problem is, which is a distraction from IRS, which is a distraction from Fast and Furious, which is a distraction from
that Marine Joe to Mexico.
Which is a distraction from... Wait, we weren't supposed to say he was killed yet. How'd you know that? Jesus Christ, right. We got to get on this. Voila, Akbar.
We will talk about this and more. I think today we will do a random rush, maybe right when we get back. So let's take a quick break. We'll take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. Of course, you can also IM the show, particularly if you have the app at majorityapp.com. Get the app, folks. It's totally free. And until I can get my act together, which generally means that we're months, if not years away from it, it is completely ad-free. So it's super free. But remember, it's your membership, because I can't get my act together to get ads on the app or anywhere else for that matter. It is your membership that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. If you want to spend absolutely no effort or money, go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap. If you buy Amazon crap through that link, we get a kickback. You've done virtually nothing except for put a smile on our faces. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Support a great company. Get great coffee. Win, win, win. I think there's one or two other wins in there, but I don't have the time to go through it. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment.